Hi everybody, I'd like to welcome you here today. We've got a very interesting session, I'm looking forward to it. It's, as you see, Community Rated Health Microinsurance for the Philippines. We've got Sachi Percy doing Purcell doing the main body of the presentation, but Peter Carroll's also going to join him in speaking. It's a very topical issue. I've previously speaking to Peter Carroll. It seems that, you know, there's obviously things just in the newspaper at the moment around other countries investigating some of these systems. So I'm sure you'll all enjoy it. In terms of the format, we're hoping to speak for around 30 minutes and then encourage some questions. We're going to record the session, so if you can come up to ask your questions at the microphone after. Obviously, we would really appreciate if you tweeted around the session and rated the session. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Sachi up to the microphone. Thanks very much. I'm terrible in terms of terrible chair. I forgot to actually say Sachi is an academic actuary at Macquarie University. He's been working in microinsurance since 2009, so obviously quite an expert. In 2011, he worked at the University of the Philippines, Diliman, for 3 months, collecting data and working with Filipino colleagues interested in microinsurance. His research in microinsurance in 2013 was funded by an Actuaries Institute research grant, which has supported the completion of 2 research papers. And Peter? Peter's been public servant, academic, a principal in an international consulting firm, and since 1994, a self-employed actuary specialising in health insurance. In 2010, he was appointed actuary in residence at Macquarie University, where he continues casual teaching and research in addition to his consulting business. So as you can see, both of them are certainly very experts at sharing their knowledge with us today. So thank you, and sorry for that.
Thanks, Elaine. Thank you very much.
This works, doesn't it? Brilliant. Very good. Okay. All right. So thanks for the introduction, Elaine. And this paper is about microinsurance. Okay. In particular, it's about health microinsurance. And that's important because most of the microinsurance that is out there is actually life microinsurance. Okay, so this is a little bit different, and the reason it's important will become clear to you in a moment, but it's important because health microinsurance is hard. It's hard to get it right, it's hard to make it work properly. Okay, so this is our attempt to try and deal with some of the issues. All right, so we hope to lead you on a bit of a journey through this. As we go through. Now, this is joint work with Peter, who's obviously here, with 2 ladies from the Philippines. Mia Pangray and Ivy Suan are at the College of Business Administration in the University of the Philippines at Diliman. Okay, so they're also, they're mathematicians, but they have a strong actuarial bent, and they've been working on this with us. And also, this work was helped by Barbara Zeitz, who is a research student who will be starting her PhD at St. Gallen University in Switzerland in September. So she was here for 4 months, and then she went back to Germany. All right, so as I said, this is about microinsurance. So I don't see anyone here who was in my last talk, which was also about microinsurance. So I will talk about microinsurance. I'll give you a bit of some details about what it is, and I can be reasonably confident that I won't bore you. All right, so what is microinsurance? Bottom line, it's insurance for the poor. Okay, how do we insure the poor? It's aimed at people with low income. It should be insurance that is offered on generally accepted insurance principles, and that's important because ultimately, if this is going to work, it has to be financially sustainable. Okay, so that bit there about generally accepted insurance principles is an important one. So what we want to do is we want to provide insurance to the poor, which is sustainable over time. Okay, and as it turns out, this throws up its own particular set of problems. Okay, how do you make this work? And indeed, when we start talking about health insurance, it makes it even more complicated. That's even more difficult. All right, so if we want microinsurance to work, there are 2 key things that are important. And those 2 key things are outreach and sustainability. Okay, if microinsurance is a valuable thing to the poor, that means we have to reach the poor. That means they actually have to buy the products. they actually have to take out the insurance, right? So to do that, outreach is important. So the bottom line there is that the insurance has to be cheap. Okay? They have to buy it. They have to be willing to buy it. All right? So that's a challenge in itself. And the other thing, and of course, naturally, as in all of these things, it conflicts with the first one, and that is that the product has to be financially sustainable. So here we are, we want to sell insurance to the poor, it has to be cheap, and we don't want to go bankrupt. In fact, we want to make a profit. You know, at least a bit of a profit would be nice. Okay, we may share it with our policyholders, but ultimately, you know, this is not a charity. We're in this to make money. Right? So financial sustainability is very important. Now, if you look at the market for microinsurance around the world, it's growing. The most dominant form of microinsurance at the moment in the world is life insurance. And there's a very simple reason why. And that is because microfinance is so important. So many of you have heard about microfinance. So microfinance is giving loans to the poor so they can start a business, so they can keep running a business. Small loans repaid over short periods of time. So this is like, you know, Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh and all sorts of other reincarnations of that around the world, in India, in Africa. And it has been in many ways successful. I mean, sure, it has problems, but it has been successful. And because people are borrowing money, there is a credit risk. There is a risk that the person borrowing the money may die. Okay, so often the people that offer microfinance insure that credit risk. Okay? Insure that credit risk by micro life insurance. So in other words, if you take out the loan, you also have to buy an insurance policy. Okay, so I mean that's the reason why micro life insurance is dominant. However, it does exist as a standalone product as well. It's a harder business to run, but it does exist, and it does exist in numbers. Alright, so that's a bit of micro insurance. Now, the thing about microinsurance, which you gather from the fact that there are two conflicting things here, it has to be cheap and it has to be sustainable. The thing about microinsurance is that it faces all sorts of problems. All right? And the problems are relative to the environment in which it exists. Right? First of all, you have high transactions costs. If you are going to sell market life insurance to the poor, you actually have to go out and meet them. Okay? You have to go out and meet them. You have to sell the insurance to them. Straight away, that's expensive. How do you do that? If you send agents out there, okay, that's expensive. Typically, these people will be dispersed in rural areas all over a wide geographical range. Okay, so it's hard, it's expensive to get these guys to go out there and sell the insurance. So that's the high transactions cost that's involved. This particular piece of work relates to the Philippines, and as most of you know, the Philippines is this enormous archipelago, this group of hundreds of islands in the middle of the Pacific. So to sell insurance, to market insurance there to the poor, really means getting in a boat, going off to an island, and then traipsing around the island, climbing over the mountains and the hills and the dales, meeting the people and selling the insurance to them. Okay, so that's expensive, right? That's an issue there. Okay, so that's one of the issues for microinsurance. Then, as with all insurance, there are information asymmetries. The person buying the insurance knows a lot more about their risks than the person selling them. So that leads to all sorts of problems which you guys as actuaries know all about, so I'm not going to talk about it. All right, limited willingness to pay. That's easy. They're poor. Okay, so you have to convince these people to buy the insurance product. Okay, so they have very limited means. You have to be able to sell to them the idea that this is a product that is worth them spending their limited resources on. Now, that can be a pretty tough sell, particularly if you're an outsider coming into a village to say, hey, buy this. You know, they'll say, well, who the hell are you and why the hell should I do this? Okay, so that limited willingness to pay is an important factor. And it also gets back to the transaction cost one. Obviously, you need to develop some sort of model where that provision of the product is put on a familiar ground to the person buying it. So in other words, if the agent comes in, probably they want to come in with the village head person, right? They want to educate the village head person first, talk to them and say, you know, this is why the people in your village may be interested in this product. Can you help me? Right? So this is sort of affinity marketing, affinity selling, where the agents or the organization identifies a group and uses that group to help them market the product. And of course that will be more successful than, you know, someone just turning up to a village and say, hey, buy this. Yeah, obviously. Okay. This is a poor community. We're selling to poor people, so the lapse rates on these products are typically high. Right? You buy your product 1 year, your crops may fail, something may happen. Say, for example, in the case of life insurance, you may not have the money to pay the premium the next year. Okay, so lapse rates are a big issue here. Indeed, lapse rates are also important because many of these people, their level of financial literacy is not that high. So what happens is they buy an insurance product, they don't really understand what insurance is. You know, they think, I've paid money for this. At the end of the year, they're still alive. I actually have received no benefit for this. Right? So they think, why should I keep doing this? They don't really understand why this is important. Okay? In our experience in the Philippines, it's wonderful what happens, wonderful or terrible, depending on which way you look at it. But if you look at a particular village, okay, people buy the insurance in a particular year. The next year, lots of people lapse. The year after that, premium income goes up again. Why? The answer is someone died in the second year. And people realize, hey, this is why we have insurance. You know, so-and-so died. They actually got this benefit. This is useful. This is worth having. Okay, so that realization then dawns upon people. Okay, so we have a problem of low take-up and high lapse rates. The other thing is, this is a product that's difficult to price. It's difficult to evaluate risks in this area. There's not a lot of data that's available, public domain data. So, and of course, there's lots of other factors that are at play in the environments in which you are selling this product. So, okay, it's a hard thing to do. Now, in the last talk that I gave, which was an hour ago, which was also in microinsurance, I was actually speaking exactly to this, talking about a data set that I'd collected and showing how you can evaluate risks for that. Okay, but that same point holds for this. And in fact, what we're going to do today, Peter and I, is we're going to talk about how you could set up a health microinsurance product for a community. Okay, and we're going to show how you'd go about evaluating and pricing the risks using tools that are widely available, even in poor communities, for someone with a reasonable mathematics background, you know, maths graduate from a university like the University of the Philippines, Diliman. Okay, with this sort of skills that they could learn from reading this paper and understanding it, they could go off into the community and they could set up their own scheme, of course, you know, with all the usual caveats. But that's what we want to do today. We're sharing our toys, right? We're sharing our toys. We're showing you how you would do this, okay? Often, you know, these are all commercial processes. We're lifting the veil. We're showing you. We've got data. We're showing you how we'd go about doing this. All right, so the focus of this paper today is about health microinsurance. So health microinsurance is very important. The last paper that I was talking about earlier, that was life insurance. Okay, this one is about health. Health is very important. Why is it important? Well, I'll give you an example. There's a guy called Anirudh, and I've forgotten his second name. It's not Khan, but anyway, it starts with K. He wrote a book recently, published by Oxford University Press. It's called One Illness Away. Now, this guy must have had bucket loads of research money because he interviewed 35,000 people around the world, 35,000 poor people. He went to 5 countries over 4 continents and he interviewed people to find out what pushed them into poverty. Right? So he gathered their life story. So he collected this enormous amount of data, right? And then he analyzed it and... what's the title of his book? One Illness Away. Health. Health and sickness are the most common preventable cause of new poverty. What happens is you're living in a village, someone in your family gets sick, you have to divert resources to looking after that person. That can mean that a child in that family doesn't go to school, they miss out on their education, they miss out on investing in their human capital and increasing their earning potential. All of these things keep happening, right? And that's led the conclusion, and this has been reproduced in other studies, not as vast as in the One Illness Away book, but other studies have also shown that this is an important factor in preventing people from falling into poverty. Indeed, where health microinsurance schemes exist, academics have studied them. Okay, so our good friends, Bill and Melinda Gates of the Gates Foundation, they've poured a lot of money into microinsurance. With the caveat, they've said to the microinsurance people around the world, they've said, we'll give you millions and millions of dollars, but you have to tell us whether this works. So what happens when you wave money at an academic? They run off and they do a study, right? So there's all these academics who've run off all over the world and they're studying microinsurance. And some of the findings that they've come up with is that health microinsurance is something that improves measured health outcomes. Okay, so in places where you have health insurance schemes, health microinsurance schemes, you end up with people with better health outcomes. So this is a successful thing. This is something that we want. This is another tool that society can use to improve the well-being of its citizens in poor countries. All right, so that's why health microinsurance is important, and that's why we are doing this paper today. All right, our focus is on the Philippines. Okay, so Peter and I went to the Philippines last year. Okay, there aren't many pure microhealth policies in the Philippines. Very hard to find them, right? So what we did is we went there last year. Okay, we were going to team up with our mates at the University of the Philippines and we were going to sit down and we were going to try and come up with a way of producing a good health microinsurance policy that would work in the Philippines. That was our objective. Now, let me give you some background about what happens in the Philippines. The Philippines does have a national health insurance scheme. Okay, so there's something that's called PhilHealth. PhilHealth is a national scheme. People who are very poor pay nothing, and they are entitled to health care. Okay? People who are not very poor have to pay something, and they are entitled to health care. So there is a national health insurance scheme, and that's wonderful. The only problem is it's imperfect. Doesn't really work. Okay? They're rolling it out. The wheels have sort of fallen off. In 10, 20, 30 years, it may be working fine, but at the moment, it's not, right? It's not working well. Okay, so many people just don't have health insurance. So, I mean, an example that we were told, which is interesting, is a woman has a baby, she's poor, she is entitled, she can get a midwife to help her deliver the baby. There's a fee for the midwifery delivery. I don't know, it could be, 5,000 pesos. I've forgotten the numbers. We had the numbers. We did the interviews. We did a number of interviews. That's what it costs. Now, you can actually get that money back through PhilHealth. But the process of getting that money back through PhilHealth is so difficult that the midwife just doesn't want to do it. So the midwife says to the woman, look, just give me so much cash now, which is a lot less than the figure that PhilHealth would give her, and that's it. We're done. Right? So as you can see, PhilHealth is just not working. Right? If you're rich, that's great. There is private health insurance. It works very well. Right? But it very much works around the American model, where you have full risk rating of product, of benefits. There are exclusions. And if your employer will often provide this care, very much along the American model. Right, so we did interview some private health insurers who market to that area, that segment, and you know, we were ushered into a very nice boardroom, okay, which looks very much like, I don't know, the boardroom in PwC in Darling Harbour, right? But when we went to see Nerissa Santiago, who's one of the actuaries at PhilHealth, we had to go up in this rickety elevator, and I think we had to climb stairs as well at some stage, went to this, you know, this tiny little room, which was, it was pretty ordinary, okay, and that was her office. Okay, so you know, there's a very big difference between these two things. All right, so what was our idea? What did we come up with in all of this? Okay, well, we want to provide health insurance to the Philippines. We want it to be cheap, affordable, and we want it to market it to a large segment of the community. So our idea that we came up with, because we come from Australia, is we thought, why not use community rating to offer the product? Now, this is something that in the Philippines, it's not really widespread at all. Okay, we come up with maybe one product that's offered by Microinsure. They sort of seem to offer this sort of a health insurance product. We're not really sure. Mia and Ivy are looking into it. But this idea of using community rating to produce a micro health insurance product, this was our idea, and this is what I'll now talk about. How did we follow through with this? Okay. Well, I mean, it's a good idea because it's essentially a cheap way of dealing with health insurance. It's something that's widely appealing because people feel they're all on the same level, they're all being treated the same. It's efficient, right? Peter will actually talk about efficiency at the very end if I don't run out of time. So, I mean, it's an efficient way of doing it, and because everyone's in the same boat with community rating, it engenders a sort of feeling of community. So people are all, say, clients of an NGO, or they all work together in a particular regional area. They all feel they're in this together, right? They're, you know, no one's being discriminated. Everybody's paying the same, right? So they feel that they're all in this together. So community rating would probably work, all right? Let's see what we've come up with for our community rated scheme. So what we did is we tried to put together a scheme. We did interviews. We talked to lots of different stakeholders in the Philippines, different groups, NGOs, other people, actuaries, and we said, you know, what sort of a policy, a reasonably simple sort of policy would work in the Philippines to provide health care? Now, who are we providing health care to? Well, we don't really have to worry about the bottom 25% because they're more or less looked after by PhilHealth, right? Okay, that's the National Health Insurance Scheme. We don't have to worry about the top 25% because they're more or less looked after by their employers. Okay, they're wealthy enough to look after themselves. So what we're interested in is we're interested in this 50% in the middle. Now, these people have to pay a premium to be members of PhilHealth. Most of them have their own small businesses. They're small entrepreneurs. They might run what's called like a sari-sari store, which just means they sell goods on the side of the road. Okay, they may be taxi drivers. All those sorts of, you know, they're essentially self-employed and they make enough, right? But they're not poor enough to be very poor, so they're not really catered to by PhilHealth, but they still need health care. If someone gets sick, then who's going to run the store? If someone gets sick, who's going to drive the taxi? Okay, all of these things are important. So what we did is we tried to develop a product that worked for that niche, the people in that middle 50%, not the bottom 25, not the top 25. And we thought about what sort of a product would work for them. So here we've used a classification scheme that you often see in the microinsurance literature, which goes through the sort of details that people need to understand a product. So I hope it's enough for you to understand this particular product. But I mean, typically we were talking to NGOs, so this would be the type of product that might be marketed to an NGO, marketed in urban Manila. Okay, we'll worry about the rural part later. Okay. Service provision, cashless inpatient cover. So this is a product that's designed to provide health insurance for people when they go into hospital. So if they buy this product, they don't have to worry about going to hospital. If they get sick, they can go to hospital without having a care in the world. That was our objective. Right, so cashless inpatient cover when they go to hospital. The technical staff who are running this
should be simple enough to be run by specially trained people for the who work for the NGO. It's going to cover traditional hospital medical services. Okay, so again, the people who use this product can go to hospital without having to worry. It's not going to really provide anything outside of the hospital system. To be a member of the scheme, you just have to be a member of the NGO. You have to pay your membership fee to the NGO, and you have to pay the contributions to the scheme. So it's a community rating scheme. You pay a flat amount. All right, you pay this flat amount, and you're in. Maybe you get a card or something, and that says you're entitled to benefits when you go to hospital. There are no exclusions of the NGO members. As long as you're in there as a member of the NGO, you're entitled to membership. And okay, I've talked about that. The premium, okay, so we spent a lot of time thinking about what a premium was, what an appropriate level of premium was for this product, and we believe that this 1,200 pesos a year was something that people could afford in this middle 50% group. Okay, this was an appropriate level of premium. That works out to Australian 242 a month. Okay, so pesos roughly 40 pesos is roughly an Australian dollar. Okay, so that's what it costs, and that is, we believe, affordable. Like I said, we talked to a variety of people. Every time we got in a taxi, we would ask the taxi driver, hey, you know, you could go to hospital, right? If you paid 1,200 pesos a year, you know, you wouldn't have to worry about that. Would you be interested in this product? And of course, we did this after the taxi driver had talked to us before, and you know, we warmed him up for it, and they all said yes. So, you know, by the taxi driver standards of a statistical test, you know, this is working. All right. Benefit package for members, what it does is when people are admitted to hospital, they're covered for 2,000 pesos, so that's the initial day. After that, they get cover for 1,200 pesos a day. There's a death benefit, and I think that should be 10,000, not 2,000. I've forgotten. Yeah, it's 10,000, not 2,000. Sorry. As far as other benefits go, if there's any remaining money after they've been in hospital, if they didn't use their $1,200 a day, any remaining balance, they can keep that and they can use that for their own uses to continue care outside of hospital. The financing mechanism is a self-financing model, right? And the financing model is about this. Well, you saw the title, it said something about Markov chains. So essentially what Peter did was Peter set up this amazing spreadsheet to price this product. Okay, with these benefits and that premium and the decrements that were available in the market, what would this product, I mean, was it sustainable? Okay, and essentially we looked at a cost recovery rate, average premiums to total benefits, that's pretty good, 105.86%. Okay, so people are really getting value for money in this product. What does the product then look like if you are going to price it and you're going to look at its sustainability? What are the sort of things that you see with respect to this product? Well, the product is, you know, we start off in state one where you're insured and healthy. You can go to hospital. If you go to hospital, we've got assumptions on what takes you into that state. Some people will die. Some people will lapse. Okay, so there's essentially this Markov chain model, standard sort of Markov chain model around this policy. And then Peter's tapped it into a computer. And we've got all sorts of parameters based on our beliefs of what takes you into the sick state, what gets you out of the sick state, what takes you into death, right? All of those values seem very reasonable. We can get to break even with the values that we use. So we know that over time, if our assumptions work through, this scheme will actually break even, right? It's not going to go bankrupt, if our assumptions hold. And we've done some sensitivity analysis of the scheme, okay, and we've looked at what are the important things that drive the scheme in terms of where's the key? The key is here, and it shows you what sort of things cause problems. So, I mean, you know, important things are assumptions of what's the probability of going into the sick state. Okay, that's important, right? What's the probability of lapsing? You know, that's important. So all of those things are important. So we've identified the things that are important. We've got a reasonably simple community-rated scheme which would provide value for money for individuals. And we believe this is a possibility in as a product to offer as a health microinsurance scheme. And in fact, what has happened since all of this is that we actually have an NGO who's interested in running this. Okay, so we've got someone who's put their hand up and say, we think this is a good idea, we want to run this scheme. So that's what they are going to do. They're going to run this scheme. So essentially that's really, you know, what I've got to talk about. I've talked a little bit about the community rating and the essentials of the scheme. What Peter's going to do now is he's going to talk to you about why community rating is a really good idea for this particular sort of microinsurance scheme. Now I will, do you want this or do you want that?
There's a little
clickers here.
That thing.
Okay, I'll get you out of here. I'll put up your thing, your presentation.
That's not right, yeah.
And I'll click on this, so this will work. Yep.
That's my only slide. Do I need the microphone?
Okay, I'm a bit more of an actuary than Saatchi. He's a bit more of an academic than me. Just some very quick comments. What I've got here, that's life insurance, disability income benefits, home insurance, group disability income insurance, employer's liability and various other product liability products, motor insurance, group life insurance, compulsory third-party insurance, and private health insurance in Australia in 2013. That is the percentage of the money that went back to the policyholders as a percentage of the premiums for each of those products. You will see that for life insurance it was less than 40%, and for private health insurance it was close to 90% of the money went back to the policyholder. And the obverse of that is down here, if you look at the operating expenses for these different classes of insurance as a percentage of the premiums. Life insurance, it was close to 40. DIB, it was getting up towards 50. Home insurance and so on, all the way down here, to get CTP and private health insurance run at around 10% of the total premiums, the operating costs, the on costs. There is a trade-off in the insurance design between actuarial refinement, if you like, and equity issues and overall insurance. If you have things like risk rating, if you assess people frequently, you pay commission to have it distributed, and generally speaking, complex products require you to have an intermediary to distribute it. And in fact, companies purposely make their products complicated in order to give the intermediary a piece of skin in the game. If you avoid all of those things, you can... You can, in fact, get more than double the amount of the premiums going back out of in benefits to the policyholders. So there's a basic efficiency involved in having a community-rated system. And there's a whole range of reasons why that happens. One is that you don't actually have to sell community-rated products. People line up at the counter and buy them automatically, or they will go onto the internet and just buy them. As soon as you interpose some kind of medical assessment or some long questionnaire that asks people about lifestyle and all of that in the process, it makes the sale much harder to do. And furthermore, as soon as you have something like actuarial funding other complexities, if being in hospital is not enough to get a claim, which it is under community rated system. You go to hospital, you're in a hospital, the doctor puts you there, the insurance company pays. If in fact at the point of claim you have a whole lot of processes as well of saying, well, did they have HIV/AIDS? That's excluded. What was their medical history? How many times have they claimed this particular thing? Did they tell us the truth when they were assessed? As soon as you interpose all of that kind of bureaucracy in the system, you add another layer of cost. So there is actually, as I say, a trade-off between actuarial complexity and equity issues within the actuarial component, within this stuff that goes back to the policyholder. You can get equity, but all of the on-costs, all of these costs here are really payments to other stakeholders, whether they're politicians who want to regulate it,
or whether they are intermediaries who want to get commissions for distributing it and selling it, or whether they're doctors who want to be paid for assessing the people, or whether they're lawyers who want to be in the case of, for example, motor insurance or long-term liability type insurance, who want to actually have the claim assessed by a judge or a court or according to rules. As soon as you interpose all those other stakeholders in the system, the issue of actuarial equity actually tends to fade away, and the interests of all these other people that are feeding off the process become important. Now, the virtue of, in a situation like the Philippines, where the very poor people will not use where a lot of people won't use the government system because they don't like engaging with the government. There's a lot of paperwork, or they may not have paid their taxes, or they may not have paid the registration for their stall on the side of the road or whatever, or they may, the politician that's engaged in their particular community comes from a different family from the one that they come from. There are a whole range of practical reasons why people find engagement with the government system in the Philippines difficult and complicated. So putting those two things together, we don't want a system that's intermediated, rather like the ones based on HMOs and that operate at the rich end of Manila. And about 20% of the Philippines population is in what's called the 25% in the formal economy. They actually have an employer, and those employers all operate pretty much, as Saatchi said, on the American system, and they have American-style health insurance where they get assessed all the time, and there are exclusions and all sorts of rules and regulations, pages and pages of them run by the insurance company. That's fine for the rich end. For the poor end, as Saatchi said, if you're poor enough in the Philippines, you could just go to hospital and nobody expects you to pay. We believe that there is another feature of the Philippines that's significant is that a lot of the education and health are the two most important things. Every time you do a survey, what matters to people in the Philippines? Educating their children and staying healthy. They get dengue fever, they want to be looked after. They get malaria, they want to be looked after. They're not so worried about lifestyle diseases and things like that. I'm older than the life expectancy there. I'm still in my 60s. People used to say salamat to me, which is thank you, but to me they would say salamat po, and they would bow, and that means old man, we respect you. So the occupational ages from say 15 through to early 60s is the main group, and very few people live much beyond that except in the poor communities. And so focusing on them, people don't go to hospital for the reasons they go here. In fact, while we were there, the dengue fever was starting, the dengue season was starting up with the wet season, and there are advertisements on the television saying to people, only go to hospital if this happens to you, but self-treat if you get dengue fever in these ways. And after 3 or 4 days, you will know if you need to go to hospital. People don't go to hospital to have babies, for example, either. In fact, going to hospital in the Philippines, for many people, is seen as effectively a death sentence. They go there to die. And the doctors in the Philippines and the nurses in the Philippines, if they really want to advance their career and don't want to just work in the government hospitals, which we went and visited a government hospital in Manila, the two academics with us came with us, and they were shocked, more shocked than we were. They lived in the very city where it was, but they'd never been in such an institution and seen really how poor it was. I mean, people, gunshots and knife wounds and lighting up for 3 days and triage and the emergency and all of this sort of stuff. And they were very patient and very passive. And in fact, the overwhelming emotion I could see on the faces of the people there was fear. Now, the really poor people go there. Nobody would ask them for money. But there is a point where that question of paying to go to hospital or not comes up. If, in fact, this bottom-up approach that we're suggesting, that small NGOs might set up these schemes for their members of their trade union, the fishermen that they represent, the rice farmers that they represent or whatever, if they would do it, then the local community, there would be a a response in supply of private services from nurses, doctors, and other reasonably, traditional healers and people like that. If we could set up a system that could promote the development of a private market side by side with PhilHealth, but nowhere near the cost of these high-end hospitals where people like Imelda Marcos go when she gets sick, it's something in the middle there. There is a potential for there to be a demand-driven change in behaviour in the private health provision market in the Philippines. That's our idea. Simple products that people will want to buy, easily buy, easily understood. They will come to trust them because they're not going to be told that, you know, that's an exclusion. They will be able to be insurable year after year after year. Nobody's going to investigate their financial history or their medical history. Simple premiums, double the single premium for a family that includes the kids, much the same as it operates in Australia. If you can have a system like that, then we think it might just, from in a bottom-up way, just grow on its own, under its own momentum. We actually do have one of the people that we went to see, knowing we were actuaries, gave us some statistics on condition that we looked at them and gave them a report on their experience. And this was basically a health insurance system for their employees of this organisation.
Just 5 minutes left.
They were enough enamoured of our conversation with them, and we had interviews over a period of about 2 weeks with lots and lots of people. 2 interviews today, lots of taxi drivers, lots of security guards, so we had a lot of market testing of how much would you pay if you could go to a private hospital instead of going to a public hospital. And how much do you think, we talked to the people in PhilHealth and some of the doctors in the system and so on, how much would you need to get investment in private hospital development? What sort of daily rates would be required? And, you know, the statistics are actually lighter than here in Australia. About 15% of people in Australia go to hospital every year. We reckon in the Philippines no more than 10, and probably only 7% under a system like this would actually go to hospital because of the different cultural circumstances. Anyway, 2 weeks ago, these people that we talked to actually persuaded an employer, who's actually a factory owner, and the factory makes ammunition and guns, which you believe, but he wanted his, that employer is setting up and is paying the premiums on behalf of 600 of his employers to operate a community-rated hospitalisation system. Along this pattern, and so that started about 2 weeks ago. We can't tell you who it is because they want to keep it confidential for now. But we've actually got a pilot scheme going 12 months after we were there with these guys, and the quid pro quo for them is that they're getting free actuarial advice. But we're very happy to do that so that we can see how it works. So. Anyway, that's by way of why we came to the conclusions that we did. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks, Phil. Can we open it up? We just have a couple of minutes maybe for a couple of quick questions. Please, could you come up to the microphone and introduce yourself? Thank you. And we've got one other question here, so if we can maybe keep our answers brief, because I know somebody's due in a minute.
Bridget Brown. So it's just a quick question about the importance of the community rating concept.
Yeah.
For this to really work across that 50% in a completely sustainable countrywide way, do you think you're going to need to have community rating mandated for all the players? Because as soon as someone introduces risk rating, aren't you going to struggle? You know, the group example you gave is a good one because there it's kind of a clearly defined group. So if it becomes broader than that and open to individuals, will you sort of push for community rating more broadly?
Good question. Look, Australia's about the only place in the world where community rating grew up kind of bottom up. It has been imposed in some places. Parts of South Africa have got it now. Ireland's got it.
Some states in the US have got it. And you're quite right, in the USA, where there was a community rater system and a risk rater system side by side, the risk rater system cannibalised all the good risks from the community rater system, and the community rater system risk pool deteriorated. We believe there's enough separation between the employer-driven wealthy part of Manila mainly, that have got these employer-run groups, and these little rural-based or fringe communities with have NGOs sort of representing them and are prepared to sponsor these schemes, a bit like credit unions or friendly societies in our experience. We believe there's enough natural separation there. And we did talk to the people that provide the risk-rated insurance, and they mow all this political stuff about, yes, of course, we would like to cater to the poor, but it is so expensive, and how do we distribute to them? And we kind of, you know, no agents will go out there and sell to them and so on. And of course, many of these people can't read, so how can you actually get them to sign a contract? So we think there's a natural separation. But I agree with you, in the long term, community rating does have problems as it matures. But at the beginning, it's actually quite a good idea to just let, basically let laissez-faire capitalism rip and let all these groups set up all these competing community rated insurance systems, as happened in Australia in the 1940s and 1950s. It eventually got regularised here with the National Health Act in 1953, and then we had to bring in some systems to quarantine community rating, for example, from the life insurance disability trauma people from cannibalising some of the health area to keep it pure. And we had to bring in risk equalisation and various things. But that is in a system that matures. At the beginning, where you want the system to take off, as happened in Ireland, for example, you avoid all those things and you just let that free market operate.
We've run out of time. I'm sorry about that. Maybe you can grab and speak to that and have a conversation.
Sorry, I was hoping I'd get to your question.
If we can just get everybody to say thank you very much to our speakers. And I'd like to have a bottle of